Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Monday, July 31st, 2017. Friday, the big surprise came during my live Facebook video feed when I took a look at my news feed and discovered that Reince Priebus had been fired as the White House Chief of Staff. But the bloodletting continues here on a manic Monday as Trump surprises many of us by sacking Anthony Scaramucci. Now, this sets a new record. Mike Flynn held the record for the shortest stay in a post appointed by Donald Trump. I believe it was 22 days as the National Security Advisor. And the Mooch scores a new record. He lasted 10 days. And as you may know, his personal life has spun out of control. His alliance, his loyalty to the Donald, which has been defined by his firing, led him to abandon his pregnant wife. She gave birth to a child, and the Mooch wasn't there. So she has announced, or at least it leaked to the tabloids in New York, that she's filing for divorce. And typically, you know, when somebody steps down, well, he wants to spend more time with his family. Well, I don't think the family is going to welcome him back. So if I can crudely paraphrase what the Mooch said last week about White House rival Steve Bannon, well, I think Mooch is going to be spending more time trying to suck his own cock. And I don't typically descend into that kind of crude verbal spouting. But hey, I mean, this is a guy who set a new low standard for discourse in government and media and for the White House of the United States of America. And what this truly reveals to me is that Trump is a man who has universal contempt. This dawned on me when we saw the public squirming of Reince Priebus. He couldn't give him the dignity of, you know, a resignation and some sort of a send-off from the White House. He made him leave Air Force One before everybody else on Friday and sent him home. And then tweeted that he had fired Reince Priebus. And then Trump came out and gave a brief, stupid statement to reporters about how great John Kelly's going to be and that Reince Priebus is a good man, a good man. But we know that Trump uses people. And even in the Washington Post announcement today, the brief report about the removal of Anthony Scaramucci, they describe him as a tool. And that, of course, can be interpreted many ways. I'll leave it to your vivid imaginations. But the Post reports, people in the White House who supported Scaramucci's hiring had viewed his presence in the West Wing in part as a tool to hasten the departure of Reince Priebus. His usefulness had declined significantly in their eyes once that goal was accomplished, and in light of his rocky first week on the job. Now, Trump egged him on. Just like he told Sean Boy Spicer to go into the White House press room the day after the inauguration and lie about the size of the inaugural crowds. Trump was having dinner with the Mooch and Sean Hannity and Kimberly Guilfoyle and some guy who used to work at Fox as a top executive, Bill Smart or Small, I can't remember. Anyway, the Mooch left that dinner and he called Ryan Lizza of The New Yorker. And when he called in to CNN? Yeah, the next morning to Cuomo's show. He acted as if he, you know, had the full authority of the president. But where I think he screwed up is that he got more press, more attention, bigger headlines than the comb-over himself. And that's the one thing that Donald cannot tolerate. Nobody can get bigger media attention. Remember when he took that swipe at Comey back in January? Yeah, I think he's more popular than me. So, as I pointed out last week, the Mooch took on the role of a job or a mob enforcer. And because the low-level enforcer got ahead of his Don, well, mob rules say you gotta go. Now, what is curious and ironic, if Trump had any capacity for irony, is that this morning at 8:30 Eastern Time, he tweeted out a message as if he needed it to remind himself of how great a job he's doing. Highest stock market ever. Best economic numbers in years. Unemployment lowest in 17 years. Wages raising. Border secure. Supreme Court. And his final entry, no WH chaos. No White House chaos. Who does he think he's fooling? Or is this some of kind of a Dale Carnegie exercise in the power of positive thinking? And do his Twitter followers actually believe this shit? And over the weekend, he switched from beating a dead horse to tweeting a dead horse because he is continuing to prod the Senate to try to repeal Obamacare. So this is Sunday. Oh, no, this is this morning, actually just before. This is 8:16 a.m. Eastern. If Obamacare is hurting people, and it is, why shouldn't it hurt the insurance companies, and why should Congress not be paying what the public pays? These are, you know, weird references in his stream of consciousness to the subsidies that are part of Obamacare paid to the insurance companies to help offset the losses from insuring sick people under Obamacare. And it's amazing because it appears that Trump staged the Priebus firing and the hiring of Kelly. Apparently Kelly is the one who insisted that Mooch had to go. And this all kind of swept away the big loss for the Republicans in the Senate early Friday morning. But Trump can't let go of it, even to his own detriment. Mitch McConnell and the other Republicans are cringing. They do not want to revisit this issue. They also don't want to, well, maybe they do. I don't want to see Trump continue to take these sniper shots at Obamacare that disrupt the markets and that will leave millions of people either uncertain or without health insurance come next January. And it's so reckless, irresponsible, and it takes me back to this incredible contempt that he has for everyone except himself and his lovely, beautiful family. And where it goes from here, just hold on. Helmets, I think, are recommended. So who is this guy, John Kelly? We kind of just let him become the Homeland Security Director. There are a few questions asked at his confirmation hearing, but he coasted on his medals and his years in the military. But John Kelly retired and only spent 8 months in the private sector before he was plucked by Trump to take the DHS job. And during that time, he managed to earn $166,000 as an advisor on military defense issues for DynCorp. Now, who's DynCorp? Well, DynCorp is the project of Steve Feinberg, a crony of the president, alleged a billionaire. I've never checked his finances. And DynCorp, according to Steve Feinberg, is the perfect private military contractor to take over the long slog in Afghanistan. And you've heard this floated, that there's no real proposal. It's just kind of out there. That together with Eric Prince, Steve Feinberg has cooked up this scheme about how we can just use mercenaries and relieve the U.S. military of this long grind. And, I mean, that is just so medieval. It's like Game of Thrones. Hey, yeah, let's just sell out this war and we can privately profiteer from it. Now, in addition, Kelly was paid $37,000 by a private equity firm called DC Capital Partners to be a board member. And apparently, he also was planning to join a group called the Spectrum Group, But he didn't actually pick up a paycheck before he was appointed by Trump. And the Spectrum Group has, experience in Latin America. And according to the bio page for Kelly there, he leads the border security team and supports clients working in security, border security, and South and Central America with his extensive expertise in the defense sector, operational and logistics support, diplomatic relations, and security. So John Kelly is available for hire, and currently he is on duty as the White House Chief of Staff. The information I just shared with you came from a website called littlesis.org, and it is a website that purports to expose the truth about Big Brother. Get it, Little Sis? And when you click a few times, you find out that the major funder there is George Soros. So if you're allergic to Soros, you can take that into account regarding that little item about John Kelly. But I think it's accurate no matter what source it came from. There's a powerful article that surfaced today, and I want to thank Jerry Freshia, our listener in northern Italy, who sent me a link earlier this morning to antiwar.com, and a powerful commentary written by David Stockman. Now, Stockman was a controversial member of Ronald Reagan's cabinet. He was a guy who rammed through those tax cuts on the Laffer curve, and at one point he admitted that the Laffer curve is bullshit, and Reagan had to publicly shame him. He called it taking him to the woodshed. Well, Reagan would be quivering, and he'd want to send Stockman to Gitmo for this one. But I really encourage you to read this. I've linked to it in the show file for the podcast. And it refers to the one area where I have said that I agree with Donald Trump. And that is ending the mythology that we can covertly fund so-called moderate rebels in Syria, and that it will work to both defeat the Islamic State and take down the Assad government. And I've never supported this. You know I've been consistently critical of it. And so I welcome David Stockman to this critique. And he refers to the Trump tweet that we talked about, and Trump was actually trying to dump a turd on the Washington Post when he tweeted, "The Amazon Washington Post fabricated the facts on my ending massive, dangerous, and wasteful payments to Syrian rebels fighting Assad." Now, putting aside the swipe at the Post and the claimed fabrication, the tweet admits that he ended massive, dangerous, and wasteful payments to Syrian rebels fighting Assad. And what David Stockman does is paint this as McCain's war. He refers to him as Senator McWar of Arizona. And the McCain responded to Trump's tweet with this statement, "If these reports are true, the administration is playing right into the hands of Vladimir Putin." Stockman responds, "That's just plain pathetic, because the issue is the gross stupidity and massive harm that's been done by McCain's personally inspired and directed war on Assad, not Putin, not Russia's historic role as an ally of the Syrian regime. Since 2011, McCain has been to the region countless times, advising, organizing, directing a CIA-recruited, trained, and supplied army of rebels dedicated to the overthrow of Syria's constitutionally legitimate government. Several billions were spent on training and arms, turning a fleeting popular uprising against the despotic Assad regime during the 2011 Arab Spring into the most vicious, destructive civil war of modern times, if ever. Yet at the bottom, this crime against humanity can properly be described as McCain's war in the manner in which Congressman Charlie Wilson's war in Afghanistan created the monster that became Al-Qaeda. The government of Syria," says Stockman, "has never ever done harm to the American homeland. It has no military capacity to attack anything much beyond its own borders. The point is, the Syrian opposition recruited by Washington for McCain's war exploited the grievances of ordinary Sunni citizens, but it was led by radical jihadist military commanders. Washington's endless charade of vetting these opposition fighters to ensure that aid only went to moderates was a sick joke." And I'm jumping to later in this lengthy essay. In a word, Bush and his neocon warriors destroyed the serviceable state of Iraq and the tenuous Sunni-Shiite Kurd modus vivendi that Saddam had enforced with the spoils of the oil fields and the superiority of his arms. In that context, the idea that the government in Baghdad represented a nation and fielded an Iraqi national army was a sheer fairy tale. What Bush and Obama left behind was a vengeful, incompetent, corrupt sectarian government backed by sundry Shiite militia. To spend $25 billion, as we did, training and arming a ghost nation was an act of incomparable folly. In a word, Wilson's war begat Sunni jihadism. H.W. Bush's war, this is the Kuwait War, turned it against America. W's war opened the gates of hell in Anbar province, and McCain's war enabled the destruction of the Syrian state and the rise of a medievalist chamber of butchery and demented Sharia extremism in Raqqa, Mosul, and the hapless Sunni lands in between. This is a searing indictment. It is well deserved. And I want to follow this up with the excerpt you're about to hear from my latest in-depth interview. Cliff Schechter had hoped to join me on Friday for our live Facebook feed. It didn't work out, but I caught up with him today, and here's one of his comments about John McCain, the war hawk.
He's been a standard, very conservative Republican, and he actually has a great, should have a greater burden to bear for what has happened to his party, because he has sat there and he has enabled it and he has voted along with it. You give a perfect example. You brought up his warmongering. I mean, he's been a leader. It's not just Syria. It's Iraq. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was out ahead of George W. Bush on that one. He was pressuring Bush the entire time from the right, frankly, to stay involved and put more troops in, and then never let up on Obama. And he was there's never been, since he changed his positions in the middle of the Clinton administration, went from being much more of a dove to being a hawk, and joined this and started hanging around with the neocons. He's never found a war or a bombing or anything he doesn't like.
There's a lot in this new interview with Cliff Schechter. It runs about half an hour, but we recap McCain's selection of Sarah Palin, his hot and cold support of campaign finance, his hot and cold support of torture. He was against it when it was politically useful to him, and many other issues that we talk about. And, of course, Cliff Schechter wrote the book The Real McCain back in 2008, and it really helps you understand the full complexities of this guy who has been, of course, diagnosed with terminal brain cancer, and none of us wishes him ill in that respect, but we're also not going to sugarcoat the real history. It's just a little straight talk, if you will, about The Real McCain. Every day I like to thank the people who support my work here at the PBC Podcast with your subscriptions. People like Benny Alto in Oregon, he's got a subscription for each of his puppies. There's Patrick Gray, Andrew Harnack, and Susan Lundgren. I'd like to thank each of you, and I want to encourage others to join in. I've lost a few subscribers. Some of them explained to me they can't afford it anymore, or they just haven't been listening. A few people can't handle what I'm talking about, and I understand. But if you're new, if you're somebody who's been listening for a while and you've got a little scratch that you could put into my account, I'd love it. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. You click on the button that says menu, then click on become a subscriber, pull it down. It takes you to the sign-up page, and you'll be good to go in just a couple of minutes after you select your level of support. And if you're allergic to PayPal, don't worry. You can mail in a check, or we can make other arrangements. Just email me if you'd like to work that out. I want to recommend an investigative piece at The Intercept today written by Zaid Jilani and Alex Emmons. And it's important to note that Jilani used to work at John Podesta's Center for American Progress in Washington. This article is based on some new hacked emails that came from a new entity called Global Leaks. And we don't know who Global Leaks is or are. And they have claimed that they're not affiliated with any country or religion, but their goal is to make America great again. So this could be a Trump-related entity. What we got are a series of emails that show that Michelle Flournoy, who was a senior Pentagon official in the Obama administration and was widely expected to become Pentagon boss if Hillary Clinton were elected, well, she set up her own think tank, the Center for New American Security, And in 2016, last summer, she billed the United Arab Emirates for $250,000 for writing a paper on the legal regime governing the export of American military-grade drones. Now, I'm not suggesting that this is criminal behavior. It might be, but I don't know enough yet to say so. But to have a well-placed Democratic official who's been in the defense establishment go through the revolving door in between administrations and earn six-figure fees for writing documents to support the foreign policy aims of a brutal dictatorship. And this was the woman that Hillary had in mind as Secretary of Defense. Now, I encourage you to read the piece because it includes communications back and forth between a top UAE official whose name is Otaiba, Youssef Otaiba. And Flournoy discusses with him this plan to try to get UAE membership in a group called the MTCR. And if you're a member of MTCR, you're allowed to buy drones. I'm simplifying it, but that's the gist of it. So anyway, she also it's disclosed in these now published emails that Flournoy contacted Otaiba and asked to help promote the sale of electronic surveillance technology from a U.S. firm to the UAE. Now, this is already a very repressive government. And here we have a nominally Democrat official who wants to sell them more surveillance toys. She was lobbying for Polaris Wireless, a company specializing in tracking electronic devices. And she wanted to help the fine people in the UAE do a better job of repressing their people. Then the Intercept article turns to the Center for American Progress, which was started and led by John Podesta for many years, and it shows how they took a junket with many senior officials, including Brian Katulis, who is a fellow at the Center for American Progress on military issues. I've interviewed him many times, and I always found him a little squishy. He was against Bush military policies, but he was quite a militarist when I spoke to him. So on a junket to the UAE earlier this year, the guest list included Michelle Flournoy, Brian Katulis, and John Podesta was on the list. It's not clear if he actually ended up going or not. But these show the connections between these think tanks that are used as places to park elected officials between jobs, that are used to influence policy, and we think that they are doing it for the common good. After all, the Center for American Progress is the only, you know, out progressive think tank in Washington. And look at the regressive relationships they've pursued. Now, we have a report here from a right-wing publication called The Washington Feed. And I want to be clear about this, that I have not been able to verify what they are reporting. But they cite one of the email chains that was released, they're saying, from WikiLeaks. But these are State Department emails, and the one in question I'm about to cite was sent by, it was between John Podesta and Cheryl Mills. Mills was Hillary Clinton's chief of staff at the State Department, a very powerful woman. And she said to Podesta, on another matter, we're going to have to dump all those emails. Better to do so sooner than later. Now, this email was sent on the very day that the New York Times reported that Hillary Clinton used a personal server as Secretary of State. And this right-wing outlet, the Washington Feed, is using this to argue that this was the intent. And they're claiming that James Comey, when he went public last July and said that he wouldn't pursue charges against Hillary, that he couldn't find intent. Now, this is not intent on the part of Hillary Clinton. So while I do see this as damaging, I think that they are exaggerating its importance, and I can't imagine why. Yesterday was a vote, a very contentious and controversial vote in Venezuela. And I'm going to give you a quick top line briefing, and then tomorrow I am scheduled to talk to Dan Kovalik, who we interviewed last week about his book about the effort to demonize Russia. And he went to Caracas last Thursday, was there through the weekend, and I want to get his first-person account. Because the corporate media reports here in the United States are framed around describing the Maduro government as dangerous and trending toward dictatorship. Now, what happened on Sunday was that people went out to vote, and the government claims there were 8 million participants, about a 41% turnout rate. And they nominated, or they selected, people who will sit on a constitution panel. And essentially, the way the corporate media describes it, this is an operating committee. The members of this new constituent assembly will have powers described as so vast that they could possibly even remove Maduro from the presidency. Now, it is packed with friends of his, so that appears to be a stretch. And it's unclear to me just how extreme and potentially dangerous this move might be. Now, along with the election activities, at least 10 people were killed in clashes with the cops. A couple of teenage boys were shot in one western city. And this clearly is a very contentious issue. But as I mentioned with Dan last week, Dan Kovalik, the U.S. media never really provides the context for what's going on in Venezuela and how the low price of crude oil hammers that nation and produces the real economic problems that they have. In Israel, their top court, their top military court, has upheld the paltry 18-month sentence that was dealt to the man who executed a Palestinian suspect, Sergeant Elor Azaria. We've seen the video of him picking up a rifle and shooting at point-blank range this Palestinian subject who was lying on the ground. I believe he was handcuffed and was not threatening anyone. I called it cold-blooded murder. But the Israeli government, led by Benjamin Netanyahu, went to great lengths to characterize this guy as a hero. And despite the court upholding what I describe as a paltry sentence, Netanyahu says that he will recommend a pardon. Yeah, for cold-blooded murder. Because it was a Palestinian, and of course, that just doesn't really matter. New York Times has a piece today regarding Vladimir Putin's reaction to the new U.S. sanctions. And we're still trying to figure all this out, because what Putin has ordered is the reduction of diplomats and embassy staff in Russia to the same level that Russians have in the United States. He says that number is 455. And according to the New York Times, there were 934 locally employed staff members, but only about 345 Americans. So it remains to be seen. The deadline for this shuffle is September 1st, and I'm still looking for more information about it. But David Sanger, the Washington bureau chief who wrote this piece called Analysis, begins with the problematic phrase: a little more than a year after the Russian effort to interfere in the American presidential election came to light, the diplomatic fallout is taking its toll. So once again, the allegations, publicly unproven, reported without evidence, based on anonymous leaks, is treated as fact. That's where we are today. And finally, a British court has ruled that Tony Blair cannot be prosecuted for his role in invading Iraq in 2003 because there is no law that fits the charges that he is facing. The ruling halts a case brought forward last year by former chief of staff of the Iraqi army who sought to prosecute Blair, along with former foreign secretary and attorney general. Rabat accused the British leaders of crimes of aggression for their decision to join the U.S.-led invasion in 2003. And I consider this to be a technicality that the court is using to protect Tony Blair. But they have ruled that there is no such law on the books in Britain, and therefore the case cannot go forward. Thanks for joining me for my daily news and comment podcast. It's delivered free, and it's available every day on YouTube. I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.